And now to another kind of questionable behavior in social situations. Allison Bruzek tells us about an annoying phenomenon called technoference.
Picture this. You're on a great date at a nice restaurant, but then your dinner date pulls out his phone. It's not unusual, says media researcher Sarah Coyne.
You'll see some couples who are more interested in their smartphone or other technological device than talking to each other.
Hey, man.
There's a reason this YouTube video, Get Off the Phone, has over 4.5 million views.
Notice this unreasonably attractive couple enjoying a reasonably priced Italian dinner together. Social networking instead of working on getting to know each other better.
Coyne calls this technoference.
Technoference is when technology interferes with your personal relationships.
It may seem harmless to check a few Instagrams during dinner, but it's a bad move for both your relationship and your overall happiness. Coyne surveyed 143 women, and 70% said smartphones were interfering in their love life. And it wasn't just the phones. They found TVs, tablets, and computers all contributed to partners feeling left out.
Uniformly, it seemed to be a negative thing for both relationships and for mental health.
She even catches herself doing it.
When me and my husband Paul are together, we'll call each other out. We'll say, hey, technoference, if somebody's right on their cell phone when we should be talking.
But you can avoid it by making a plan.
Both of our cell phones are going to be out of sight, and the ringer's going to be off when we're together. And, you know, we can check it once or twice, but only to see if the babysitter has texted or something like that.
So pocket that phone and look your loved one in the eye. Your health and your girlfriend will thank you. I'm Allison Bruzek for NPR News.
One of the country's leading design museums has been redesigned. The Cooper Hewitt Smithsonian Design Museum in New York City is reopening after a three-year renovation that cost $81 million. The goal here was to better display a collection that ranges from vintage armchairs to Jimi Hendrix posters to Victorian birdcages. The collection is housed in New York's Andrew Carnegie Mansion, and the redesign has turned this historic building into one of the most technologically advanced museums in the country, as NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Today is an important anniversary for Cooper Hewitt.
On December 12th in 1902, Andrew Carnegie actually arrived with his wife and daughter in a horse-drawn carriage.
That's Carolyn Bauman, the museum's director.
So we chose December 12th, 2014, for obvious reasons, celebrating the new Cooper Hewitt the same date that Andrew Carnegie moved in.
The sprawling 64-room mansion with its high ceilings and tall windows was once on the leading edge of home innovation.
The Carnegie home was one of the first houses in New York City to have air conditioning and an early example of heating.
And now Bauman says Cooper Hewitt is using this historic mansion to advance museum innovation. Bauman says in an age of social media, video games, and selfies, visitors are no longer content to be passive recipients of information.
So here we have the immersion room.
Bauman takes me to a second floor gallery about the history of wallpaper. At a table with a big touchscreen, I can sort through hundreds of wallpaper designs, from antique, floral, French prints, contemporary, and abstract patterns. If I want to see what it would be like in a room, I tap the design and it's projected onto the wall.
The idea was that people would better understand the impact of wallpaper by saying, look what this can do to a room. Look how it transforms the room.
If you were actually decorating your house and thinking about
wallpapers, right.
You could come here for inspiration.
Exactly, that's what we're hoping.
And you can design your own wallpaper. Bauman draws a few shapes and they replicate across the wall. I add a big dot.
Now it looks like a bunny rabbit with a tail.
Exactly. See how easily things can change?
Visitors will use a pen-like object designed by the museum to draw on this table. It looks like an oversized black crayon. Each visitor will get one during their visit. Seth Chen is the museum's director of digital and emerging media.
It's also shaped like a pen because it gives visitors the explicit permission to go and do things. It's like, hey, we've given you a pen. What do I do with a pen? Oh, I create stuff. Right, obviously I'm here to create stuff.
There are other touchscreens in the museum you can draw on and make a zigzag or a curlicue. And it brings up objects from the permanent collection that use that shape.
We see a circle pattern in this trumpet that is in this 1736 pen and ink drawing.
The pen keeps a digital record of your visit. It will have the wallpaper you drew, and if you tap an X symbol next to the display of, say, a turn-of-the-century chair you find interesting, that will also be part of a personal account that you can visit after you leave the museum.
You can look at more information, you can share it with your friends. It's a memory device.
Many other museums are keeping an eye on Cooper Hewitt. Museums have been experimenting with handing out iPads to visitors and creating special apps with audio tours. But visitors often don't use them, says Nancy Proctor, Deputy Director of Digital Experiences at the Baltimore Museum of Art.
What's interesting about the pen is it's about as far away as you can get from an audio tour device. That's really exciting as an invitation to all of us in the museum field to kind of think outside that audio tour box.
Cooper Hewitt will now also have the ability to learn more about what gets visitors most excited about their collection. She says this is important to attracting young donors, many of whom want proof that their money is making an impact. Museums are also struggling to attract younger visitors. According to a survey by the National Endowment for the Arts, the number of visitors between 35 and 45 is declining. Cooper Hewitt director Bauman hopes that by making the experience more interactive, that will begin to change.
This renovation, the past 3 years, was really the lifetime opportunity for Cooper Hewitt to modernize, to renew, to become something new.
The museum opens its doors today, though the new technology will continue to roll out over the next few weeks. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
And now a debate over a much more modern form of news delivery. Google News is a popular variation on the traditional Google search engine. It links to news content from around the world. By doing that, it brings readers, but no money, to the news outlets producing the content. That is changing in Spain, where a new law will soon require news aggregators like Google and Yahoo to pay Spanish news agencies. Google's response? It's shutting down Google News in Spain. From Madrid, Lauren Freyer reports.
The new law is intended to protect Spain's news industry. It's popularly known as the Google tax and goes into effect in January. Spanish newspapers lobbied for the law, but
I haven't read a single comment from any tech expert in Spain or outside of Spain that says anything positive about this. They're all negative.
Matthew Bennett is editor of the Spain Report. He's happy that Google News brings web traffic to his online publication.
This kind of initiative is not good for brand Spain and the image of Spain that the government worries about so much abroad in terms of the way it's dealing with technology and situations in the 21st century.
Google says it doesn't sell advertising on Google News and makes no money on the service. Paying fees for linking to content, says Google, is unsustainable. So as of December 16th, Google News will not be available in Spain, and no content from Spanish news outlets will appear on Google News anywhere. Bennett recently registered his website in the UK, so he'll still appear in Google News. But the end result, he says, is that fewer people around the world will get news from Spain.
So this sort of diffusion effect that Google News had, allowing us to find lots of different stories from lots of different sites, that's going to disappear now for readers in Spain, and also for lots of international readers trying to use Google News to look at Spanish news.
The reaction here is summed up in this popular tweet. Have you heard the news from Spain? Well, you won't anymore. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Madrid.
Some businesses make money the moment they put out their product. Others figure it out as they go. And often the users of the product are the ones who teach you how to make money. That is exactly what happened with the Chinese company YY. Zoe Chase from NPR's Planet Money team reports.
YY started out as just this social network for gamers. So you didn't have to play League of Legends by yourself. You'd make friends across China and play together. But there was this gaming-specific problem.
There's no time for them to type text. When they play games, they are very concentrated, so they are very busy with their hands.
Eric He is an executive with YY. So they put in this high-quality audio software so players could just talk to each other in real time. Asman Wang is a student at NYU. He plays games on YY all the time.
What are they saying to each other?
Oh, just like, be careful.
Be careful, watch your back, there's like a monster coming?
Yeah, like in the game.
And this is how Wang stayed connected to his friends in Shanghai when he moved to the U.S., in these sort of virtual chat rooms, playing World of Warcraft together. The company grew fast. Growth, but no profits. Things changed when the company noticed that inside these chat rooms, people weren't just playing games. people were singing. If you set up a way for anyone with a webcam to get a large audience and you provide high-quality audio, people are going to karaoke. This is a video of a young lady who goes by the name of Cotton Rabbit. Slim, young-looking in her bedroom, and she's really popular.
It said there's 3,249 people online and watching this video. It's a live show.
That's Yang Guo, an interpreter. The show is live. Cotton Rabbit is performing right at this moment.
It's 11:12 p.m. in China now.
At first, as the karaoke videos multiplied, the YY guys didn't see the money there. Until this one moment, Eric Ho says they decided to have a contest.
We were trying to figure out how should we rank. Performer A is better than performer B.
They gave their users these free virtual tickets so they could vote for their favorites. A little later, the YY guys are online on Taobao, a huge internet marketplace.
We found out that someone offered to buy that ticket.
The tickets were on sale for about 25 cents a piece.
That was like lightning to us. We realized that the little ticket actually means something.
People would pay for them. People wanted to show appreciation to the karaoke singers. This was the breakthrough. Now on YY, you enter your bank account and you can buy little presents for the singers, like emojis. Things like
the cotton candy and the lollipop. You can also send her the sugar candy, beer, the heart means I love you, kiss and hug, and you are the best. Yeah.
They're all a few cents each, 10 cents, 15 cents, but as we watch, I see someone send Cotton Rabbit 66 magic wands. That's about $3 US. And this is key, Cotton Rabbit gets a cut of that money, and YY gets 60%, which actually adds up. YY still is the games, but more than half their revenue now comes from the music business. And they offer these expensive VIP packages for up to $20,000, and people buy them. And some performers make thousands of dollars a month off deals like that. Turns out, YY's customers really, really wanted to pay for virtual cotton candy. And now they get to. Zoe Chase, NPR News.
Popular ride service company is valued at a staggering $40 billion, even though it's besieged by lawsuits, bad PR, and outright bans in some places.
Today, Uber was roundly criticized for raising fares in Sydney during the hours of the hostage crisis. Meanwhile, the company was banned in New Delhi, sidelined in Nevada by a court order, and France just nixed a low-cost Uber service over licensing rules.
Nonetheless, Uber and similar services like Lyft and Sidecar continue to expand. Uber says it has hundreds of thousands of freelance drivers around the world and says it will have a million more on the road in 2015. NPR's Laura Seidel reports on what it's like for people who decide to drive for the company.
This is what Carl Theobald used to do for a living. For a decade, he played sax for Teatro Zinzani, a local dinner circus along San Francisco's waterfront. Redevelopment plans shut it down. So a year and a half ago, Theobald signed up to be an Uber driver.
Hey there.
What's up?
Hey.
It's 5 p.m., rush hour. Uber drivers like Theobald have an app that lets them know what parts of town have surge pricing, where demand is high.
When a zone is in surge, it lights up in red on our map, and you want to be in the surge because that's where the prices are higher.
Theobald splits his day so he can catch the surge pricing during the evening and morning rush. He says this is a much bigger hustle than working for the circus.
I was making about the same amount of money doing that I am doing Uber, but working, you know, 4 hours a day instead of, you know, 10.
That is 10 hours a day now, during which Theobald says he averages $25 to $30 an hour. Theobald says he does like the work.
I'd much rather play saxophone, but I enjoy this. It's fun driving around the city talking to people all day.
For some drivers, working for Uber and other new car services is the choice career.
Hey, good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
How are you?
Isaac. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet
Isaac
you.
Alfandari used to be a salesman, and he's still got the outgoing energy of a self-starter. In 2011, he was laid off.
I was one of those guys in the Great Recession that lost my job. Right then and there, I decided I don't want to go back and do what I was doing, which was, you know, selling stuff and having a sales manager over me.
At first, Alfandari tried driving a regular taxi cab.
I had to work a 12-hour shift 6 days a week in order to have the job. And that's kind of indicative of a lot of the cab driving world. You know, the bosses make you do things that really most people wouldn't do.
Alfandari is still hustling. He started driving for Uber, Lyft, and Sidecar. He says he's making more money than driving a taxi, though drivers in other cities like New York say driving a cab can be more lucrative. Alfandari invested money in a higher-end car. He's driving a Ford Explorer SUV. He's got a website, theblackcarguy.com, where he gives advice and coaching to other drivers.
I work for me. Uber's a client. Lyft is a client. My coaching students are clients. Because I'm out here to do an awesome job for myself and the companies that I work for. And this allows me the freedom to do that.
Uber also has the freedom to change its prices. That's exactly what's upset driver Carl Theobald. For example, earlier this year, Uber began taking an extra dollar off the top of the fare as part of what the company calls a driver safety fee.
Which doesn't seem like a lot, but when you're doing 150 fares per week, that's $150 that's taken off the top.
Both he and Alfandari have been told by Uber they're among the company's top earning drivers in the Bay Area. But other drivers say they don't do as well. Claire Callahan Goodman worked part-time as a software programmer when her daughter was young. More recently, she thought driving part-time for Uber might bring in some extra money.
And in the beginning, they give you these bonuses, like there's a signing bonus. They start paying you before you've even driven. And you think, well, this can't be all bad.
But eventually, Callahan Goodman stopped driving. She was working in Berkeley and Oakland, which aren't as busy as San Francisco. She says with the upkeep of her car and Uber fees, it wasn't worth it. But ride companies like Uber expect turnover, and they will be continuing to recruit drivers aggressively over the next year. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
The hacking of Sony Studios' computers has led to a multitude of stories about Hollywood grudge matches and backroom deal-making involving some of the most famous names in entertainment. Sony has hired a new prominent lawyer who's warning news organizations, including NPR, they must destroy copies of any of the emails and documents and that they may be breaking the law in publishing these stories. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is following all this and joins me now. And David, why don't you walk this back, talk a bit about the hack itself and some of the many salacious details that have been reported.
Well, so this all started right around Thanksgiving week when some anonymous emailers came forth and warned Sony that they were going to post some pretty damaging stuff, and they proceeded to do so. There have been thoughts that these hackers have ties to the North Koreans because one of the demands ultimately was that they not release this upcoming Seth Rogen caper film involving a harebrained CIA plot to kill the dictator of North Korea. But the North Koreans dispute this, and the FBI says there's no evidence to support that. Some of the stories that came out were pretty juicy and pretty embarrassing for Sony. There were advanced copies of unreleased films put on sites for dissemination, clearly to damage the studio. There were questions of clear salary disparities between men and women at Sony Pictures, as well as disparity for the pay of Jennifer Lawrence versus some of her co-stars. And additionally, the co-chairwoman of Sony Pictures, Amy Pascal, was shown an email chain kind of disparaging an Angelina Jolie project involving a movie to remake Cleopatra. So this was one series of embarrassments after another in recent days and weeks.
Well, Sony has hired, as we mentioned, a high-profile attorney. It's David Boies. What's his warning been to news organizations, and what's the foundation of his argument?
Well, to be honest, Boies writes these letters to a lot of news organizations, as you said, including NPR, and he's offered a hodgepodge of reasons. He said there's an attorney-client privilege being violated, that Sony has intellectual property rights to the material that's being disseminated, that there's confidential corporate information that's been revealed, and that everyone needs to destroy this material, whether they have it directly or if they have access to it indirectly. They need to make sure this material does not get out. Sony Pictures has rights, he says.
And you've been running that argument by some outside media lawyers. What do they say about it?
Well, I talked to several today. One of them, a prominent lawyer for a top media company, said this fell under the legal doctrine of so sad, too bad, other than the question of releasing what are so far not yet released films, which I think the intellectual property law would tend to protect very much Sony's rights on. But, you know, there was a Supreme Court case a little over a decade ago which expanded the rights of journalists. It was a case in which a radio station broadcast illegally taped conversation between two local union officials, but the radio radio station wasn't involved in that taping and didn't solicit it or try to acquire it. It was given to the radio station. In that case, the justices ruled in a majority that the journalistically there was a public interest in it and that there was a right to know. And that trumped any sort of third-party involvement in that illegal act.
And David, I gather that you think that the legal warning coming from Sony and its attorney is really more about atmospherics and damage control than an actual legal threat. Why is that?
Well, there are a couple of elements to it, one of which was that Boies initially sent the letter to a lot of big news organizations in recent days, some of which, including NPR and the New York Times, have not been leading the pack or been particularly aggressive in reporting this story. Meanwhile, Gawker, which has been very interested in attuned to this story, only just received that legal note. And Fusion, based down in Miami, a joint enterprise of Univision and ABC News, which published some very embarrassing stories about the gender salary disparities at Sony, and Fusion tells me it has not yet received a copy of that letter. It seems to me that it's not simply about getting the material back. In addition, I think what you've really seen is Boies has successfully achieved at least a partial shift in the conversation. We're now talking about the legality and the morality of going after the material in those leaks instead of about the stories themselves.
Okay, NPR's David Folkenflik. David, thanks.
You bet.